It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. We have a sweet show for you this week. We'll talk cakes inspired by history with a brilliant pastry chef. We've got Boston cream pie with America's Test Kitchen. We've got an incredible story about a pilgrimage in India to cook for a goddess. And we'll hear about an iconic writer who mused on both feasting and fasting. But let's get to dessert first. When I was in culinary school 15 years ago, I knew a woman named Stella. She was a pastry chef in the making, and we really didn't know each other that well, but she was smart and thoughtful, and at some point, I went through a really rough patch where I really needed a friend, and she was there, and she showed me true kindness. Well, she graduated not long after, and we fell out of touch, but 8 years later, we found each other on the internet. She'd become that pastry chef, but even more, she'd begun writing a quirky, terrific blog, and eventually got more and more into writing about the science and history of desserts, getting inspired by how classic cookies and cakes and pies and puddings were made in the past, and then reimagined those recipes for the present. And just a few months ago, I was so thrilled to see her first cookbook, Brave Tart, debut on the New York Times bestseller list. So hi, Stella. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to talk to you about the subtitle of your book, actually. It's Iconic American Desserts. So what makes a dessert iconic American?
I really wanted the book to be a collection of desserts that the majority of us could say played an important role in our childhood. So for me, growing up in Kentucky, sweet potato pie was a tremendously important dessert that we always had around the holidays and that, you know, people just made in general. And I realized pretty quickly that, you know, outside of the South, not a lot of people were eating sweet potato pie. And so that's not iconic. It's a very American dessert, but it's not iconic because there's plenty of Americans who, you know, born and raised here, this is their country, this is the culture that they love, and they've never had that. And so I didn't want the book to be a collection of regional desserts or desserts that were important to some people but not others. I wanted it to be this celebration of all the desserts that connect us together coast to coast.
So how did you decide what qualified?
Maybe it's kind of like that classic quote about porn that you'll know it when you see it. But you kind of have this instinct, right? Like, I mean, something like yellow cake. Betty Crocker and Duncan Hines have ensured that yellow cake is something that all Americans have had a chance to try and love. And we all know what white cake is, and we all know what chocolate chip cookies are. And so on a certain level, some of it's instinctual, but then there's other ones that loom a little bit larger due to pop culture, something like key lime pie. And so that was kind of at least a starting point for determining what it was. And some of it was a little bit crowdsourced on Twitter and just asking people, like, how did your mom make whatever? How did your dad make whatever? And then when there'd be a good response and a lot of feedback, people talking about their memories about these desserts, that I'd know for sure that was a good one. And if, you know, it was like crickets chirping on social media, then I'd be like, okay, this is more of like a regional thing or more of a niche dessert that maybe isn't central enough to American cuisine to want to include.
Sure. But you mentioned chocolate chip cookies, which, you know, a lot of people make from the Toll House recipe on the back of the chocolate chip bag. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned yellow cake before, and you talked about Duncan Hines. And how much of it is about that? How much of it is about our dessert life, our national dessert consciousness is formed by these items that, you know, were popularized by some company that was trying to hawk a product?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge part of it. That's perhaps the overriding theme of the whole book, is how much marketing and advertising and corporations and back-of-the-box recipes really influenced what we bake, and that someone who's living in Nebraska is making the same type of desserts as someone living in New Hampshire, because they're both getting the same Good Housekeeping magazine that has the same advertisements from the same companies. And it really proved to be a unifying factor. And I think maybe a more cynical person would look at that and think it was, you know, sad or an indictment of our culture. But you know, we have a really large country, and it's remarkable that we can all identify with these desserts. And so in that way, I think that advertising and marketing really proved to be a positive force, a unifying factor that we can all kind of unite behind in something as simple as a brownie.
Yeah. I want to ask you about red velvet cake. Because before you, I always thought red velvet was just a nice way of saying, you know, kind of bland chocolate cake with tons of red food coloring. So tell us about the real history of red velvet cake.
Yeah, absolutely. So red velvet cake started out from a larger tradition in Victorian era where there were velvet cakes. And really, this was just like a way to be fancy and at least indicated that the cake had a very soft and velvety crumb. You know, in the 1800s, a coarser textured cake was a little bit more common for the day. And so to have a cake that had this soft, soft, velvety crumb was, you know, very, very appealing. And then there was also simultaneously a devil's cake or devil's food cake. And this was like an intensely chocolate cake that was made with egg yolks rather than whole eggs and oftentimes coffee or something in there. So it was really dark, really bold flavor, really dense and fudgy. And sometime in the early 20th century, I'm kind of personally pinning it around, say, 1911, the two collided, the two concepts collided, and there was a recipe for a velvet cocoa cake that was published. And this was kind of like a cross between a devil's food cake and a little bit more of a classic concept of a velvet cake. But it was made with cocoa powder in place of chocolate, so that was like the biggest distinction. Mm-hmm. And so then the recipe, as it drifted south, was often executed with buttermilk. And what happened was the acidity of the buttermilk, it doubled down on the acidity in the cake overall. In that time period, most cocoa powder was not only natural, it was also raw. Modern cocoa powders, the beans are roasted. And the combined effect of the acidic buttermilk and the acidic cocoa powder created a sort of density in the texture of the cake, which amplified the velvetiness of it. And simultaneously, the pH of the cake helped some of the color pigments in the raw cocoa powder shine through a little bit more. And so that's why the trick doesn't really work today when people say like, oh, well, red velvet came from a reaction in the cocoa powder and you can do this at home. Well, you can't really do it at home unless you get raw cocoa powder because the type of cocoa you're picking up at the store is going to be a roasted product and not raw.
Yeah. So the red didn't refer to the sort of garish food color red. It was just sort of like a ruddy brown.
Yeah, absolutely. There was a food scientist in the 1930s who commented on it, and she called it a red-brown hue. And she was trying to be very clear about the reaction that was happening, that the pH of this cake batter produces a sort of reddish-brown hue. But that's not really a very sensational story. And so when newspapers were picking this up and talking about the cake, because at the time, the idea of a red devil, which was an alternate name for the velvet cocoa cake. The idea sounds great. It sounds red, but in practice, it really just distinguished the color of this light cocoa cake from the inky blackness of a devil's food cake. Yeah. And so this was a little bit more of a Depression era. Like, let's scale back here. Let's use cocoa powder instead of chocolate. Let's use some like old sour milk in the back of the fridge. Like, pulling from these like a little bit more thrifty ingredients. And so it made a less sensational cake. But in order to make a good story out of it, when newspapers would cover it, they definitely played up the red aspect and kind of left off the brown aspect.
And then sooner or later, people wanted it red because they kept hearing that it was going to be red.
Yeah. There's a recipe from like the 1940s, and it had like 4 ounces of red food coloring in there, which is insane. It's, you know, a quarter of a cup of petrochemicals.
Yeah.
That's pretty scary and intense, but it made an outrageously colored cake. And, you know, from there, red velvet really did take off because obviously that's a very eye-catching thing.
So tell me about your recipe for red velvet cake now that you've done all this research.
With my recipe, I really wanted to get back to the velvetiness that really, you know, defined the original cake. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to get back to the raw cocoa powder, which is a really cool thing that we can source now on, you know, websites online. It's easy to grab. And so by by using raw cocoa powder, the flavor comes out so much more, and it's such a more interesting flavor than just a mild chocolate. And I also use red wine to kind of play up the fruitiness of the raw cocoa powder and to also kind of like cash in on that chemical reaction that once upon a time made the reaction between raw cocoa powder and buttermilk so impressive. Red wine does something really similar while also playing up those fruity notes.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for coming in, Stella.
Thanks for having me.
Stella Parks is the author of Brave Tart, Iconic American Desserts. And you'll find her recipes for red wine velvet cake and for magic key lime pie on our website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, one of the most influential women in food that you might never have heard of, Patience Gray. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. It's The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. I'm Francis Lamb. A dish that's literally fit for a goddess. Leslie Parisot went to Kerala in the south of India to see an annual pilgrimage where literally millions of women come together to honor a goddess. And at one moment, they all cook the same dish for her, all at once. Our producer Sally Swift talked with Leslie about this astonishing event.
Leslie, great to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Sally.
So I'm dying to hear the story about this pilgrimage in India. But first, I want you to tell me a little bit about Kerala and that area of India.
Yes. Kerala is it's a beautiful place. It's on the southwestern coast, very near the tip of India. And it's tropical, it's humid, there are beach towns. And at this time of year, it's very, very hot.
And tell me about this pilgrimage. What are these women doing?
It's a pilgrimage where millions of women travel to one city to cook a dish together. And that's simplifying it a little bit. But it really is, it's about devotion to one goddess. And they're traveling to the home of this goddess and her temple in a city called Trivandrum. And the trains are filled with women starting a few days ahead of time who are all going to this place. The fares are actually suspended for women who are going, so they have a free ride. And the women are taking with them a single bag usually. They have a bag that is filled with all of the ingredients that they need to cook what's called pongala. And the entire ceremony revolves around arriving to the temple, arriving to the city, and everyone's setting up. And what they're setting up are a makeshift hearth of three bricks, a clay pot, and some usually coconut bark for firewood. And they set up all over the city. So they're.
And how many women are you talking?
It's been about 1 million or 2 million.
Wow.
Yes, it's hard to hold in your mind thinking about what 1 or 2 million women look like. And this year, the temple actually reported that it was close to 4 million women.
Wow, big year. Okay, so they are all going to a single temple that's devoted to a goddess, correct?
Yes. The way that they refer to her is Achukal Amma. She's sometimes conflated with another goddess, and there's such mythology around all of this. This is what's so interesting about this goddess. She's an incarnation of a female deity, usually known as Bhadrakali, and she's worshipped locally by these women, and she's seen as sort of a giving figure, but also a very intense, strong, and sometimes furious figure.
So set the scene for me. So you are there and these millions of women are setting up makeshift hearths with three bricks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to cook simultaneously, mm-hmm. which is an amazing thought. And tell me about what they're cooking.
So on the morning that this happens, women wake up very early. They wake up to prepare themselves. They wash their hair. They wash the rice. They dress often in new clothing. I was told that women are often bringing a new outfit just for the ceremony. And then they all gather around the hearths that they've made. The city actually provides the bricks for the hearths and sometimes the pots. And they wait until the signal from the temple comes. And the signal is that the priest in the temple lights a fire. And that fire gets passed on from woman to woman. And then there are also volunteers running around helping to light hearths. So all at once, at the same exact moment, all around the city, there are speakers set up. Women light a fire. And they all start cooking. So what's actually really incredible about this is the smell. You're walking around the city. All of the smoke is all over the place, and everything smells like burnt rice and fire and coconut bark. And these women, it's 97 degrees. They're sweating. There's smoke in their eyes, and they're all praying. They're all looking at their pots, looking at the sky, all in the same act of devotion at the same exact moment.
Wow. And they're really cooking. So tell us, it's a rice porridge?
Yes. So they basically, they start off, they have a clay pot over an open fire. They add water. They wait for the water to boil. And then they have this specific kind of rice. It's called Carolyn rice or red rice. It's got a partial husk left on, so it has a red hue. And they scatter rice into the pot, usually in three handfuls. And then they wait for the pot to boil. And part of the ceremony is that the pot must boil over to satisfy the goddess. So when you look around, all of these pots are bubbling over, this sort of steamy, what's beginning to be a rice porridge.
And they eat it then?
They do. So they spend time cooking it so that the rice gets soft like any rice dish would. And then at the end, they add all of these seasonings and sweet flavors. And it depends on where the women are from. Some, you know, some women say that you have to add ghee because ghee is a purifying sort of symbol. Many women add ginger. There's always coconut. There's always cardamom. There's always what's called jaggery, which is an unrefined palm sugar. And at the end, they cover their pots. Once it's cooked, they cover it with a banana leaf. And they wait for a priest to come around. This could take hours. And sort of in this interim time, they eat lunch, they sit around, they rub each other's shoulders, they nap. And then when the priest comes, they all get behind their hearths again. They take off the banana leaf, and the priest comes and scatters holy water over their pots. And then they're free to eat it. And this moment is so beautiful because it's the thing they've been waiting for all year. This is a sort of symbol of feeding themselves, feeding the gods, feeding their families. And they all take a spoonful, they taste each other's pongala, they feed each other, and then they put the banana leaf back over top, they pack the pots away, and they leave.
Leslie, it's such a beautiful story. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Sally.
Leslie Parisseau is a contributing editor at Sever Magazine. You can read her article, The Sacred Journey, in Sever's Pilgrimages issue, and you'll find the link on our website, splendidtable.org. Patience Gray's cookbook, Honey from a Weed, is a big, odd book. It was written over 20 years. It's poetic about both abundance and hunger. And it's the definition of a cult classic. But few people outside of that cult have ever even heard of the fascinating woman who wrote it. Adam Federman's new biography of Gray, Fasting and Feasting, tells her complicated life story. And our contributor, Russ Parsons, talked with him from Los Angeles.
Adam Federman, welcome to Splendid Table.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Adam, your book describes Patience Gray as the most important food writer we've never read. And she was a fascinating person who led this very multifaceted life. Who was she? What kind of person was she?
Yeah, I suppose there's something a bit counterintuitive about making the claim that an author most people have never heard of is one of the most important food writers of the last half century. There were many incarnations of Patience Gray. She was born in West Surrey in the south of England, grew up mostly in the country, although she went to Queen's College in London and then the London School of Economics, had a remarkable experience during the war, raising two children out of wedlock, and lived in a tiny cottage owned by her mother. through to the 1950s when she returned to London and took up a career as a translator, editor, and writer, eventually publishing her first cookbook, Plat du Jour, in 1957. And then, in fact, went on to be the first woman's editor of The Observer, which was quite possibly the most important newspaper in London at that time. And you know, all of this preceded her Mediterranean Odyssey, which is really what she's known for. Everyone who knows Patience Gray knows her through Honey from a Weed. So they think of this woman who lived this very intrepid, rugged life in Greece and Italy and finally in Puglia, the very south of Italy. And this is unquestionably one of the most fascinating chapters of her life, but it's by no means the whole person. But Patience and Honey from a Weed occupy a sort of unusual place in the world of food writing. The book is considered to be one of the best books on food ever written, and yet Patience remains almost completely unknown. Patience was a contemporary of Elizabeth David, another British food writer, and M.F.K. Fisher, who have far greater notoriety than Patience does. And Patience wrote about food and ideas in food that have really become mainstream today. So in some ways, it's surprising that she isn't better known. You know, I still encounter people today who say that Honey from a Weed changed their life. And you know, that's something you don't often hear about a cookbook.
Yeah. Patience's first cookbook, Plat du Jour, it was published in the 1950s. It was extremely influential in England. What was it like, and how did it set the table for her future work?
Plat du Jour was a remarkable book. And as you say, it was a runaway bestseller, published in 1957, and one of the first mass market paperbacks of its kind. Penguin, up until that point, hadn't done a lot of cookbooks at all, let alone cookbooks aimed at a mass market audience. And the book covered a wide range of European cuisine. It was mostly based on the countries that Patience and her co-author, Primrose Boyd, had traveled to before the war. And it embodied the same kind of romance and sort of wanderlust that many of the books that Elizabeth David had written earlier in the decade also did.
It's a dinner party cookbook, let's put it that way. Honey from a Weed is completely different. It's a really idiosyncratic book. It's anything but a cookie-cutter, modern market cookbook.
Yeah, Honey from a Weed brings so many threads together, and I think part of the explanation for that is the fact that it was written over the course of a 20-year period, more or less, and really reflected the life that Patience and her partner, Norman Momans, had lived throughout the Mediterranean. It combines sort of personal essays with recipes, reflections on the landscape, esoteric subjects like anarchism and Carrara. And then on top of that, it offers what I think is probably the most comprehensive and remarkable sort of field guide to the edible wild plants and fungi of the Mediterranean. And it does this in a comparative way that is really unique. You know, she includes Greek, Catalan, Italian, English, and even Salentine dialect words for these plants and fungi. So you get a real sense of the context and the relationship between these various foods and the countries that Patience lived in.
We've talked about Honey from the Weed as a philosophical work and as a guidebook to esoteric culinary knowledge, but it's really full of delicious recipes, too. What were some of the favorite things that you cooked from it?
Yeah, it is a remarkable cookbook, and I should also add a very accessible one. I think the recipes that tend to get referenced from it are the esoteric ones, you know, like fox or something along those lines. And I think it tends to be a book that people read and don't cook from, but I hope that changes. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago at home in Vermont, I did one of her pasta dishes, which is just spaghetti boiled in heavily salted water. And in a large bowl, you put some fresh ricotta. And before you're finished cooking, you ladle some of the pasta water into the bowl, mix it with the ricotta, drain your noodles, toss them in the bowl, mix them, grate a little bit of nutmeg over it, ground black pepper, and it's just a wonderful dish. And I think that kind of dish is sort of what Honey from a Weed is all about.
Wonderful. Adam Fetterman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was great to be here.
Adam Fetterman is the author of Fasting and Feasting, The Life of Visionary Food Writer Patience Gray. Russ Parsons is the author of How to Pick a Peach. You can learn more about Patience and find one of her recipes at splendidtable.org. Every week, we check in with our friends at America's Test Kitchen to see what they're up to. And since we've got iconic American desserts on our brain, we want to talk to them about the classic in their backyard, Boston cream pie. And we had hot questions for them, like, is there such thing as a good one really? And why is it called a pie when it's obviously a cake? Our producer Sally Swift got Bridget Lancaster to defend Boston cream pie's honor.
Hey Bridget, great to have you back.
Thanks Sally, good to be back.
So Boston cream pie, I mean, I don't want you to feel responsible for defending Boston cream pie being from Boston, but I do have a question for you. First of all, it's a cake, so why do we call it a pie? And second of all, I don't think I've ever had a good piece of Boston cream pie.
Oh, boy.
Well, so I guess I am asking you to defend it.
Well, so there you can have really good Boston cream pie. I'm like you. It's really hard to find it out in bakeries that are good. You know, sometimes the cake is so rubbery. It's so sweet. There's so much sugar between the cake itself, the sponge cake, and that custard filling, and then the chocolate on top. But the pie part of it that you mentioned is really interesting. Mm-hmm. We did a lot of research trying to find out exactly what they meant by pie. What it came down to was, we think, and what food historians have told us, is that the pie plate was one of the most used pieces of bakery back then. So they baked everything in pie plates instead of cake pans. So it was just natural to call it a pie.
Huh, okay.
At least that's my story, and I'm sticking with it.
So you guys have taken this apart and reassembled this old American recipe for the home cook. Can you tell me what you did?
Yeah, sure. Well, you think about, there's three components to a Boston cream pie. There's two layers of sponge cake, and in between is a layer of vanilla pastry cream. So, you know, so far, so good. You've got sponge cake and you've got pastry cream, and then they pour over this chocolate glaze.
Yeah, so that should be delicious. And as I've said, it has not always been. What did you guys do to make it friendly for home cooks?
Well, we ditched the sponge cake.
You did?
Yeah. A traditional sponge is super finicky. You take eggs, either whole eggs or egg yolks, and you beat them with sugar until they're foamy. And then you have to delicately fold in a flour mixture. And those little trapped air bubbles from beating the eggs and the sugar together, that's the only leavening that the cake gets. So if you overfold in the flour, you're going to deflate the mixture and you're going to have a really kind of squat Boston cream pie. Mm-hmm. Very, very rubbery at that point. So we switched over to something called a hot milk sponge cake, which is a little bit of a Betty Draper style retro recipe. It couldn't be easier to make. You take milk, a little bit of butter, you heat it together until the butter melts. You take some eggs and sugar, and you do beat that until it's nice and fluffy. But then you pour in all the milk mixture, and then you stir in some flour, a little bit of salt, and baking powder. Again, baking powder is going to make this foolproof. The cake is going to rise every single time.
And you do two of those, or you do one and cut it in half?
Nope, two of those. Much easier to do two of those. And the other part of this is there's some butter in the cake. That makes it more tender and less sweet. You know, a traditional sponge doesn't have a lot of fat in it. You need that fat to counter the sweetness.
Okay, so there we have the cake. So what goes on with the cream?
All right, pastry cream. There's two ways to make a traditional pastry cream. Again, you take eggs or egg yolks and you mix it with a little bit of sugar. And then you pour in hot half and half, and you have to be really careful. You want it to temper, you want it to start to thicken, but you don't want it to curdle, and you also don't want to undercook it, otherwise it can be too thin. And what we found, there's two ways to do this. The starch you can add is either cornstarch or flour, and flour is going to make the pastry cream work every single time. Cornstarch is 100% starch, and that really does have the ability to thicken very well. But if you don't heat the mixture enough, there's some enzyme in the egg yolk that will actually prevent the cornstarch from thickening enough. So you end up with a mixture that's just too thin. And then also, if you mix a cornstarch thickened pastry cream a little too much, it will start to thin itself. You're basically breaking down the structure in there and causing some of that moisture to weep out. But flour has, in addition to starch, it has some fats, some lipids, and also proteins, and they work as binders. So you not only have the starch from the flour, but these extra powerful binders that thicken the pastry cream and it stays thick. So it works every single time.
I mean, pastry cream is really scary for people. So it sounds like you have absolutely eliminated that issue for us.
And, you know, here's a little hint that somebody once taught me. If your pastry cream curdles a little bit, it doesn't really matter. You just pass it through a fine mesh sieve and nobody will ever know.
Okay, last but not least, the chocolate glaze.
Oh, this is the easy one. So a lot of chocolate glazes are made from chocolate and heavy cream, and you pour it over the cake, but it can be kind of dull. The original recipe, the Boston cream pie that was made at the Parker House Hotel in Boston back in the 1850s, they mixed chocolate with a fondant mixture. So basically they boiled water and sugar together until it got to the softball stage, a little bit of cream in there too, and then added the chocolate, and it makes it very brittle, almost like candy. We wanted something that was sliceable. It was thick enough to cling to the cake and not just all pour down into the serving dish, but also stay nice and supple and be very shiny. And the key to that is just a little bit of corn syrup. A little bit of corn syrup just gives it that flexibility and shine like a freshly polished pair of black patent shoes.
Wow, you have really demystified this one. Is this one of those cakes, pies that is better after a day's rest?
Absolutely. Actually, the whole cake can be made over a few days. The cake can be made a couple days in advance. The pastry cream can be made also in a couple days in advance. So if you didn't want to put together this whole thing in one day, that's fine. But after you put it together, it really needs to refrigerate for at least 3 hours before you want to slice into it because it has to set up. Our recipe says 24 hours in advance, but it will definitely sit there for 48 hours at least. I think cakes like that that have some pastry cream in them, they're much better. Any kind of dessert that's really has a custard in it, it's much better if you give it at least one day in the fridge.
Love those recipes.
Mm-hmm.
Bridget, thanks so much for explaining this one.
My pleasure, Sally. Thank you.
Bridget Lancaster is the executive editor for New Media, Television, and Radio at America's Test Kitchen. You can find their recipe for Wicked Good Boston Cream Pie at splendidtable.org. Coming up, I get to take your calls. And later, more for your sweet tooth, the greatest sesame candy on earth, halva. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb. All right, it's time for us to talk, and you know you can always connect with us on Facebook or Twitter, but I really love taking your calls. So if you have a question for me or just feel like talking food, pick up your phone, 1-800-537-5252. And we have Fernando from Guayaquil, Ecuador. Hi, Fernando. How are you?
Very well. May I call you Francis?
Please do. Thank you for the call.
Your voice is such a familiar and pleasant one. It permeates our entire house as we have speakers in all the rooms, and we've listened to you so much and so often that you're like my brother. You've been here at home with us in Ecuador.
Well, thank you. I hope to actually come to Ecuador one day because it's incredibly beautiful. But what should we talk about?
Well, here's the problem. We live in a very hot place. When we get a real, like, our nor'easters are like 85 degrees, and that's when we put on a sweater. It's very hot and very humid all the time, so stuff spoils really quickly. We refrigerate everything and, you know, even refrigerate things like red wine and sometimes even salt. Not so much because salt needs preservation, but just to keep it dry. And so we really are very careful with, you know, how we store things. And one day we were having a party and a friend came, and a friend had just come from Italy, and he brought us a huge piece of prosciutto, a huge chunk, like 3 pounds, something like it's like 6 inches by 5 inches by about 4 inches high, a huge piece of prosciutto.
Oh, wow.
It's just my wife and I. We love it. In fact, we call it jamón crudo, or raw ham. And we do enjoy it, but we didn't know what to do with this enormous chunk. And so, in the midst of the party, my wife says, "What should we cut it? What do we do?" I said, "No, just put it in the freezer for now." And she put it in the freezer, and it's been there. And anyway, we have no idea what to do once we defrost it, because we cannot possibly eat 3 pounds of prosciutto before it would spoil. And I am totally committed to your suggestions, because this morning, knowing I would be speaking to you, my wife pulled it out of the freezer, and it's currently defrosting in our refrigerator.
Oh, wow. So you're okay.
So there's no turning back.
Yeah, there's no... you've cut the Gordian knot on the frozen prosciutto.
I have
to say, this is an interesting problem. I am honored that you would trust me with it. I hope I don't fail you. I have to say, I've never actually had to deal too much with a giant frozen block of prosciutto before. That's a
me
unique
neither.
And in some ways a blessed problem. Now, I have to tell you, given the fact that it was frozen in a home freezer, I don't know how well it's going to defrost. Meaning, if you flash freeze it...
That was one of my questions, too.
Yeah, if you flash freeze meats and things of that nature in an industrial freezer, that can work because it freezes it so quickly that the ice crystals stay pretty small. They just like flash freeze and then they're there. In a home freezer, because it takes a while, the ice crystals start to grow and they start to poke through the cell walls. And so you may find that it'll leak some juice, and you may find that the texture when you bring it out is not going to be quite as firm or, you know, sort of toothsome as it was before. Maybe not as delicate. That said, if it's not totally defrosted, what I might think about doing is, if you have a deli, or if you have a deli slicer yourself, or if you know a deli nearby, maybe consider running over there and having them slice it thin while it's still partially frozen. So you can slice it thin, you know, package it however many slices you might have at a time, and then if it's still kind of still frozen, you can refreeze it without too much damage. That said, the other thing you can do now is... hey, you know, maybe you won't have the same beautiful texture as when it was, you know, originally fresh, per se. But start thinking about cooking with it.
That's what I was going to ask. Is there a cooking solution? Because I thought the same thing, that it would probably, once it was defrosted, even if it was sliced up, it wouldn't be quite the same.
Yeah. I mean, I would think to use it in ways where maybe you're wrapping it around something, maybe you're wrapping it around a piece of chicken, you're wrapping it around something, and then you can sort of sear it so it becomes a layer of flavor. You know, you can cut it into chunks and use it to stew some vegetables. It'd be beautiful with green beans. It'd be beautiful with greens. Treating it like a salty cured ham. If you're not in a position to be able to enjoy it in its sort of like silky, thin sliced state.
No, I assume that thin sliced phase of its life is over, and that it would be something along these lines. I wondered we even thought maybe just putting the whole thing in the slow cooker and sort of braising the whole ham and seeing what happened.
You know, I have never done that, but it's that thing, right, where, like, freedom's another word for nothing left to lose.
Right.
So, hey, try it. And I'm sure someone in Italy would, like, you know, roll in their grave when they heard someone done this to a prosciutto. But, hey, I'm sure it'd be delicious because all the flavor is still there for sure. The texture may not be, but all the flavor, all that beautiful cure flavor is going to be there. So if you do that in a slow cooker, I'm sure the liquid that comes out would be incredibly rich and delicious. It'll be quite salty. So, of course, you want to think about that when eating it. You may want to, you know, cut it up into pieces and use it to flavor a larger dish instead of cooking the whole thing. But, or, you know, in the American South, they have these cured hams that they do exactly that with. It's cured, it's air dried, and then when they prepare it, traditionally you didn't slice it and eat it thin. You took the whole ham and you would boil the whole ham, and much of the salt would come out. You might save some of that liquid and that liquid would be incredibly beautiful. You could freeze that and use that as a stock or as a flavor base for other stocks, and then eat the meat.
You know, I think I like a lot the idea of cutting it into chunks and using it as a flavor enhancer for, you know, vegetable dishes and maybe sauces and things like that. I kind of like that idea. In Argentina, which is where I was born, we have a dish called puchero, and one of the things, it's like a big giant stew, one of the things we used to do was put a big piece of pork belly, you know, not like sliced bacon, but a big like square of it into the puchero mm-hmm. as a flavoring. And as a kid, I would always fish through the entire pot looking for that thing to eat it. But so I kind of like that idea. Might
yeah,
try different
try
things,
that for
like
sure.
cutting it in half and using some of it for chunks for adding to vegetables and stews and stuff like that, and then the other half slow cooking and see what happens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or if you cut it, dice it up nice and small, you can start that in a pan. It'll render its fat. Maybe you can add a little more olive oil or other fat to the pan. When they get a little mm-hmm. bit nice and brown, scramble some eggs in that, and that would be mm. so delicious.
Well,
yeah, I would go
fantastic.
Simple. I would like use the prosciutto with something that's maybe one or two other ingredients, you know, just really kind of feature that flavor because, I mean, it's a beautiful flavor, whatever you do with it. Thanks so much for listening all the way from Guayaquil.
Well, thanks so much for this fantastic advice.
Oh,
I
my pleasure.
Plan to put actually all, we have enough to put all of it into practice. So.
Yeah, let us know how it goes.
I sure will. Thank you so much. Be well.
Thank you. Take care. All right, we have a message, a question from Tim from Fort Charlotte, Florida. So Tim wants to master bone marrow, how to cook it, how long, what to pair it with, etc. Okay, so bone marrow is incredibly delicious. It feels so wrong when you eat it. There's something so super primal about digging into the bones that I feel is a little bit emotional, but it is incredibly delicious. And a friend of mine once referred to it as, oh, it's meat butter. And that's really kind of gets at it. It can be so rich, so buttery in the flavor, but definitely a little more intense, definitely a little bit meatier and more animal. So the simplest way to prepare bone marrow is you got to get it cut from a butcher because you're not going to want to cut it at home. And I like what they call a canoe cut, which is they take the marrow bone and they cut it lengthwise. So it opens up and you have two nice long bones with like a little divot of the marrow inside. Now, a chef, Chris Cosentino, who is a master of offal and who's one of my authors, I confess, his method is to drop those cut bones into well-salted, really cold water, and then basically brine them overnight in the fridge. And you might even want to change the water once in a while. And what this will do is draw out the impurities and draw out the blood so you're left with really nice, clean, white bone marrow. Now the next day, you take them out, you dry them, season with a little salt, get your oven blazing hot, 450, put them on a tray, you know, keep them kind of level because they're going to get pretty liquid in the inside. The marrow is going to get pretty liquid. And then just roast them at 450 for, I don't know, maybe 10 minutes. Keep an eye on them. When they start to bubble and maybe you get a little bit of browning around them, you're pretty much done. Take them out. And because it's so rich and such a unique flavor, I like to keep it pretty simple and have some toast on the side. Maybe you smear it on toast. Maybe a little salad of fresh herbs, parsley, maybe a little bit of lemon zest. You know, keep it really simple. You want those things for freshness. And maybe a little squirt of lemon just for a little acid. But it's just such a cool, unique, beautiful flavor. I would start there. And remember, we love hearing from you. Get in touch with us anytime, 24/7, 1-800-537-5252. Or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And so we've got one last sweet treat for you this week. It's halva. Now, sometimes it's called sesame candy, and you can find bars of it in Middle Eastern or South Asian stores, but I confess, I never really loved it until I had it fresh, sliced off a wheel at a deli, and now I'm obsessed. So halva is made from tahini, which is, you know, sesame paste, and sugar, and the good stuff is flaky and tender, like the inside of a Butterfinger bar. If somehow you found the world's most delicate Butterfinger bar, like stashed in a lab somewhere at Butterfinger headquarters. And Lisa Mendelson is one of the three women behind the company Seed & Mill, which sells the best halva I've ever had. They swirl in flavors like salted chocolate. Melissa Clark from the New York Times talked with her about this magical tradition.
Lisa, hello.
Hi.
So tell me, what is halva? So halva is a delicious, indulging, better-for-you treat. It's made from tahini, which is a sesame seed paste, and sugar, vanilla, and added all different toppings. A lot of people aren't familiar with what halva is, but once you try it, it has a very unique flavor. Halva is mainly found in the Middle East, but it's becoming more and more common in the US and in Europe. And it's usually vegan and gluten-free, and it's just a very delicious treat.
And so in the Middle East, how is it usually eaten? Is it just a dessert, or do they use it in cooking?
So first of all, I grew up in Israel, and for me, halva was something I ate on a weekly basis. I would wake up in the morning, have some toast, and just crumble some halva over my toast, which is so delicious.
That sounds so good.
I eat it as is. I think it's a beautiful treat. It's definitely also a better for you choice if you're looking for something sweet with some sort of health nutrition benefits to it. Mm-hmm. I bake with halva.
And is it traditional to bake with halva, or is that something that you and I know other pastry chefs have started to do recently?
I think it's becoming more common today. It was less common in the past. I mean, growing up in Israel, I never baked with halva. But I think in the past few years, you're seeing all chefs, like if you look at Ottolenghi, he's the one that basically brought Israeli food to the map. He's got so many recipes that actually have halva as an ingredient.
So Ottolenghi obviously is the chef from London who is all the rage in really across the world, but especially in the United States right now. So why can't you make halva at home? I have tried and I can never get it quite as delicious as the store-bought.
So the actual list of ingredients of halva is pretty simple. It's tahini, sugar, and whatever topping you would like to add to the halva. But actually getting the amazing texture is really difficult. And it takes a lot of practice to get that flakiness of the halva. Getting the right temperature, when do you add the tahini? It's a fine art.
Now, you have a roster of really unusual flavors. You know, you have the traditional vanilla, pistachio, almond, and then the chocolate. But then you also have dulce de leche, and I think you have chili, right? How did you develop your flavors?
So it's interesting. What's fun about working with halva is that it has a very neutral flavor. It tastes a bit like it has a nutty. Some people compare it to the inside of a Butterfinger chocolate.
Yes, I think that's a good comparison.
And what's really fun is that you can be very creative with halva. You can add so many different flavors, and the dominant neutral flavor stays. But then you've got the adding of the chia seeds or the rose oil, which gives it a unique flavor.
Now, how do you store halva? If you want to buy it, you buy a chunk of it usually, you buy like a slice, and then what should you do when you get it home?
So because our halva is clean and has no hydrogenated oils or any of the preservatives, what's very important is that it is refrigerated, not because it's bad to eat, but it starts losing its firmness, and you can see some oil separating if it's not put in a very cool area. So we do recommend to keep it refrigerated.
Now, obviously, you know, Seed and Mill is, of course, your brand, but are there other brands on the market that you could recommend if people can't get yours?
I would try and find halva that are freshly cut in delis as opposed to packed, because you do have bars that are packed. And usually the chance of getting a high quality halva is higher at a deli where they cut it for you. But it's not easy to find very good quality halva out there.
Look for a Middle Eastern deli that's cutting it fresh.
Exactly.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for coming and talking to me today.
Thank you.
Lisa Mendelson is one of the owners of Seed and Mill. Melissa Clark is the author of Dinner in an Instant. Well, that's the show this week. We hope you thought it was as sweet as we did, and join us again next week. And in the meantime, let me leave you with this from the pastry chef Emily Lucchetti. On an emotional level, I'd rather smell like chocolate and strawberries than garlic and shrimp. SplendidTable.org is the place to get everything you need to know about the stuff you heard on today's show. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast. You can find interviews, both past and present, with the people shaping the food world. And if you like us, please leave us a review. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lupke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our assistant producer. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.